Good morning. Yeah. Got a new preacher this morning. Shorter hair. Yep. All right. Well, glad to be back. We had a great trip. We're going to jump right into Joshua 13 this morning. The last time we were together, we looked at the commission that God gives to Joshua at the beginning of Joshua 13. Right? So at the opening of the book, we get this commission where Joshua is going to go in and conquer the promised land. And here, that commission is replaced in a way. In fact, that commission is brought to a close. And God gives Joshua a new task, right? He says, you're old and advanced in years. There remains yet very much land to possess. This is the land that yet remains, all the region of the Philistines, all those of the Geshurites, from the Shehor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron. It is counted as Canaanite. There are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim in the south, all the land of the Canaanites, and the Mara that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebelites, and all Lebanon toward the sunrise from Baal Gad below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamat. All the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon to Mizrapoth Maim, even all the Sidonians. All right, so that's a lot of territory left out. Those are a lot of people that are left unconquered. And God tells Joshua, I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel. So this is no longer Joshua's job. Joshua's job now is, now therefore divide this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh. While I'm thinking about it, it just uploaded a map of the territory that Israel has conquered up to this point. So, remember, if you go to, let me find it, if you go to the website, 14avcoc.org, up along the top, click online resources. I'm going to abbreviate this for time. Click online resources, then Bible class handouts. There should be now, let me refresh this and make sure that it's there. There should be now, yes, a file. It's currently named Land Conquered. It shows a map of the area of Israel that is occupied by Israel at this point in history. And you'll see there's a lot of Israeli land, of Israelite land, that has not been conquered yet. God says to Joshua, I'll take care of this myself later on. Your job now is to divide the land for an inheritance. And so that brings us to the second half of the book of Joshua. So the first half of the book has been all of this warfare, the conquering of the land. The second half is going to be where Israel actually takes possession of the land as an inheritance. And so before we enter into dividing the inheritance, I want us to spend a little bit of time in connecting these two halves of the book together. Because the Hebrew word for inherit means to possess. All right, in fact, we've seen it already. Let's see. At the beginning of the chapter, when the Lord said to Joshua, you're old and advanced in years, there remains yet very much land to possess. It's the same word there for inherit. Right, so whenever the scripture talks about Israel's inheritance, about its possession. Those are interchangeable words. But here's a really interesting thing. That same word in Hebrew also means to dispossess. Right? We've got a few words like this in English where the word can mean one thing and can also mean the exact opposite of that. Right? This is an instance of that in Hebrew. It can mean to possess and to dispossess. And this tells us something about the meaning and the process of Israel's inheritance of the land. Because remember how inheritance works in antiquity. So if you've been around for some of our studies in the Old Testament, especially our Law of Moses class, I've talked about this a lot. Who is responsible for giving the nations their inheritance? Right, so in the ancient world, you've got all of these nations occupying certain territories over the ancient world, and who's responsible for giving them that territory? I mean, you're kind of close there. So one of the things that we read, let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 32 in one of the songs of Moses. We're not going to read the whole song. It's really long. Deuteronomy 32:8. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. All right, so at least it's Israel's understanding, it's Moses' understanding, that who gives the nations their inheritance? God does. All right, why do the Canaanites get to live in Canaan? Because God gave them Canaan. Right now, again, remember how inheritance works in antiquity. What happens to your land when you die? Yeah, it goes to your sons. Or if you don't have any sons, it can go to your daughters. Right? Your sons inherit it. Your oldest son gets a double portion of the inheritance. But it's passed down from father to son. How long does that go on? How many generations does that go? Yeah, it's indefinite. There's not like a cap on that. Like, hey, you get this for 10 generations and then it's kind of up in the air and doesn't really matter. This is something that's meant as a perpetual inheritance. It's something that we read in the law, for example, pertaining to the year of Jubilee. Right? Part of the purpose of the year of Jubilee is to make sure that if there have been any land sales in Israel over the course of 50 years, that land reverts back to the family that originally owned it. Again, that happens every 50 years, or at least it's supposed to. So that every family in Israel will always have something. Right? Even if things go bad for them, even if things go south, they will have an inheritance. They'll have a place to live. They'll have something to leave behind to their kids, and this is meant for a perpetual inheritance. So before somebody can possess a territory, the first owner must be dispossessed of it. That's the way that we find things working in antiquity. Again, just selling the land is not sufficient, at least in an Israelite context. Right? You sell the land and it's not gone forever. He comes back eventually. All right, so up to this point in Joshua, before this point in Joshua, who were the rightful owners and inheritors of the land of Canaan? Well, up to this point, all right, so has Benjamin been given an inheritance yet that we have read about? No. Has any tribe of Israel been given an inheritance yet? Technically, a couple of them have, that we'll read about again. Remember, on the east side of the Jordan, the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they have already received their inheritance. But none of the rest of Israel has yet. That's what we're about to read. So who owned all of that land? It's the Canaanites. They are the rightful owners and inheritors of Canaan up to that point. It's the nations. Right, the six or seven nations that we read about in those lists all of the time. The Canaanites, the Hivites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, etc. They are the rightful owners and inheritance of the land. It's essential that we understand this point and that we work out exactly how and why Israel comes to inherit this land. Because I think sometimes we get this notion in our head about what's going on in Joshua. It gives us the wrong picture of things. So let's come to a right picture of things. From what we know of the Old Testament, does God give land? Does God give an inheritance conditionally or unconditionally? Right, we said he gives it perpetually, right? So the land will keep coming back if you sell it away. It's supposed to come back to you. It's supposed to be indefinite. But is that arrangement unconditional? Like it'll happen no matter what? Or is it conditioned on something? It is conditional. What's the condition as far as Israel's concerned? Yeah, they have to stay faithful. Obedience to the law. In fact, a big chunk of the story of the Old Testament is how Israel is just continually not faithful to God, disobedient to the law, and ultimately God dispossesses them from this promised land. Right, the promise is not unconditional. It's always conditional. We've read many, many warnings in the law of Moses. Ultimately, if they disobey the law, God will eject them from the land. Right, just we'll pick up a quick example of this. Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26, this is a long section with blessings for obedience to the law and curses for disobedience. And the curses section is considerably longer than the blessings section. God really lays it on them thick. But we're going to focus on just one part of the curse. Verses 32 and 33. All right, so this is, just to lay the ground for this, God's telling them this, that you know, if you don't listen to me, if you walk contrary to me, if you disobey the law, you go after other gods, right? I myself will devastate the land so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled at it. And I will scatter you among the nations, and I will unsheathe the sword after you. And your land shall become a desolation, and your cities shall be waste. All right, just a quick example of that principle that we're talking about. And Israel, again, has known this from the very beginning. Excuse me. That they will be driven out of the land. They will no longer have a possession for themselves. God will decimate them. Now, here's what's going on in the book of Joshua. The story of the conquest, so that first half of the book of Joshua that we just finished reading over the last several weeks, the story of the conquest is how this principle holds true for all the nations. Now, this is not just something that applies to Israel, although what we just read in Leviticus is directed at Israel specifically. This is a principle that holds true for all the nations. And this is the reason why Israel gains the promised land. All right, so again, there's this false image that we can get in our heads about the conquest. The conquest is not the story of how God arbitrarily stole the other nation's homes to give it to his favorite pet nation. And sometimes we treat it that way. Right? Like God takes this land just for no reason, just because he likes Israel. You know, and if you happen to get booted out of your land because you're not Israelite, well, too bad, so sad. Suck it up, buttercup, you're going somewhere else. Or if you're going to die, right, as we've seen play out in the book of Joshua. God likes Israel, he doesn't like you. So just lay down, you just dig yourself a hole and get in it, because you're in the grave already. That's not the story of what's going on in Joshua. He's not just arbitrarily taking the Canaanites' land because they're not Israelite. The story of the conquest is God's judgment on the nations. And it coincides with his blessing of Israel. Right? He's essentially killing two birds with one stone. He is giving Israel the land that he has promised them, and he is judging the nations who have been in that land historically. And this is something that has been kind of teed up for us for a long time. Right, go all the way back to Genesis chapter 15, and we see this being teed up. Genesis 15, is the Lord is talking to Abram. Again, this is so early on that his name hasn't even been changed to Abraham. Way, way back in Israel's prehistory. We'll start in verse 12, Genesis 15, 12. As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and there will be afflicted for 400 years." All right, so of course, what event is he talking about in Israel's history? Yeah, he's talking about their enslavement in Egypt. All right, they are going to be slaves in Egypt for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve. So he's going to bring judgment on Egypt. And afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation. For, here's the important part for us, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet right, meaning that this whole process that we read about with Israel in the Old Testament, where Israel is faithless, you know, they don't listen to God, they ignore him, they disobey the law, and God is patient with them, and he's constantly, you know, saving their rear ends, pulling them out of the fire, despite the fact that they are not changed in any way, they're not penitent. And God spends centuries doing that with them. What we just learned here is that God goes through that exact same process with the other nations as well. Right? It's not, you know, Israel doesn't get all of this time just because they're God's favorite. God, what we learn here is that God kind of treats all of the nations. He is really lenient with them. He gives them a long time to repent. All right, here we're talking about the 400 years of the captivity plus the amount of time leading up to that. All right, from the time that God is speaking to Abram here, he is giving them all of this time to turn from their ways, and ultimately they don't. And so what we're reading in Joshua is when the bill finally comes due for the nation. And this is what ties the two halves of the book of Joshua together. Joshua, the book of Joshua, is the story of God dispossessing the nations and giving Israel a possession. All right, and remember, those two words, dispossess and possess, are two forms of the same word in Hebrew. And that's what ties all of this together. There's a two-part process going on in the book of Joshua. It is not just God arbitrarily kicking people out of the land to give the land to his favorite pet nation. All right, so any questions or comments about that before we continue into the text of Joshua 13? Solomon?
Parallel there to like how the Gentiles, they're drafted and Paul's response to the angry Jews is like, well, why does God find fault with me and stuff like that?
Yeah, there's, again, you do find that same thing playing out in physical Israel. Right, so that ultimately, and we know that these promises were ultimately meant for Israel in a spiritual sense, so that God's promises extend out, again, not just to sons of Israel, but to everybody, right? They're open to everybody. But this same kind of warning, the same kind of threat continues to extend to us in a spiritual sense today. If we can find some parallels to this all the way forward in the book of Revelation, when the Lord is speaking to the seven churches of Asia, and one of the warnings he gives them, remember that we have this image presented where the seven churches are represented by these seven lampstands. Like lampstands that you would see in the temple or in the tabernacle, like the menorah. And one of the warnings that Jesus gives to the churches is, hey, if you don't straighten up, I'm going to remove your lampstand. Right? It's exactly the same kind of message that he was giving to the nations, that he was giving to Israel, extended to us today.
Yeah, it's like in Romans 11, where it says, provided that you continue in his kindness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I think 11 is right. It's in 9 through 11. Yeah. That you continue in his kindness. So, good point. Wayne?
Just an offhand sort of side comment here, though, as a little lesson per se. But if you have to go through the earth and find the prime land, you know, as far as real estate goes,
uh-huh.
That little tiny strip of land right there would be in the top five. And the reason for that is, you got to remember, there's a very, very major, major trade route going right straight through there.
Yeah.
And it connects not only Egypt on the one end, but all of Africa also. And
yeah.
On the other end, all of Asia and all of China, was, you know, on top of that.
Yeah.
Plus, you also have the ports that are there that go into places like Europe.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And this place is primo, right central, in the very hub of all connected throughout the whole world.
Yeah, it is a major crossroads.
It is the best place. If you want to get rich real quick, that's the place to be, because everybody brings their goods and services right through there. You get the benefit of all that.
Yeah.
That is the best place to be.
Now, piggybacking off of that, if you look at that map that I've uploaded, one of the things that you will notice is that most of the best land in Israel has yet to be conquered. A lot of the most fertile land for agriculture has yet to be conquered. Right? You talked about ports. Israel doesn't have any of them at this point. They've not conquered any of it. There's a lot left to be done, and we will see, continuing forward, whether they actually do what they are supposed to and take possession of the rest of this land. All right, let's see. I think we've got enough time to continue into Joshua chapter 13. And now we've got a basis for what's going on here and why Israel gets this land. Go to Joshua 13, verse 8. All right, now, up to this point, actually, let's remember what God has just said in verse 7. He gives this new commission to Joshua. Now, therefore, divide this land for an inheritance to the 9 tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh. So, wait a minute, there's 12 tribes in Israel. What's going on here? Why 9.5? And at this point, the text goes back and reminds us that the other 2.5 tribes have already received their inheritance. So let's start in verse 8. With the other half of the tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them, beyond the Jordan eastward, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and the city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland of Medeba as far as Dibon, and all the cities of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, as far as the boundary of the Ammonites, and Gilead, and the region of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and all Mount Hermon, and all Bashan to Seleca, and all the kingdom of Og in Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth and in Edrei. He alone was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. These Moses had struck and driven out. Yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. All right, so the inheritance section begins by talking about these odd tribes out. Excuse me, Reuben, Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and in just a moment we'll also see Levi lumped in with them. But this section here specifically is going to serve to remind Israel west of the Jordan of their common inheritance with everybody east of the Jordan. All right, we're going to see later on in the book why this is important, that Israel west of the Jordan be shown that connection to the east side of the Jordan. But this text also draws another connection between the work of Moses and the work of Joshua. Right? That's something that we have seen happen over the course of the book. The question is, you know, is Joshua a fit successor for Moses? Is he going to be able to fill Moses' shoes? Joshua's just received this commission to divide out the inheritance to Israel. But before turning to that inheritance, it returns back to what Moses did, and it shows how Moses was faithful in that work that God has just given to Joshua. That Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan. And so the force of this, again, is to connect Joshua's work to Moses's. We're going to see how Joshua ultimately is faithful in discharging that duty, just as Moses was. The little bit of text that we have just read is it's a summary of basically what's happening over the rest of the chapter. So we have got, in fact, let's go ahead and lay out, there's this structure to chapter 13. Assuming I can find a marker that's not dry. Okay, so we just started with a summary of what's going on. So you've got an inheritance given to Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And then it's going to turn its attention to the Levites, which we'll read about in just a second. Then we're going to see the inheritance given specifically. So we're going to get a passage about Reuben, a passage about Gad, a passage about the half-tribe of Manasseh. Then it is going to swing back around to another summary. And another, it would help if I could spell. Summary. Like a town in Alabama or something. Summary, Alabama. Another summary statement and another little statement about the Levites. All right, so the center of this is the 2.5 tribes getting their inheritance. That's the focal point of this. So let's see, we've got time. Let's go ahead and read on. Verse 14. To the tribe of Levi alone, Moses gave no inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord God of Israel are their inheritance, as he said to him. All right, so we get this really short little note reminding us, as we have already read in the Law of Moses, that the tribe of Levi gets no land inheritance. Instead, what do they receive as their inheritance? Well, they do, although we don't read about that here yet. What they're given specifically, at least what we're reminded of specifically here in verse 14, is not just God himself, but specifically, what, Rena? The blessings of the priesthood, specifically the sacrifices. Right, because remember, under the law, a sacrifice is, well, what happens to most of a sacrifice? Does it get burnt up? It gets eaten. Right? There are whole burnt offerings. Right? Where the entire sacrifice gets burnt up. And it's like the whole animal, from a human perspective, the whole animal goes to waste, quote unquote. But most of the sacrifices are not that way. Most of them have a meal portion, and that meal portion goes to the Levites and goes to the priests specifically. All right, so they are always provided for. That's their inheritance.
John? They're talking about Moses, the land east of the Jordan, correct?
Right. So they're not going to get a land inheritance at any point in Israel in the way that the other tribes do. We will find that the Levites get cities. Right? They're going to be given possession of specific cities that we'll read about later in the book of Joshua. There are some, if I remember correctly, there are some east of the Jordan. They have the land to support the city.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the ones that they would offer for themselves. Yeah. So, good point. All right, so this is something, again, we're reminded of in the Law of Moses that Levi gets the offerings by fire. Let's see. We're pretty close to the end here. Let's go ahead and at least get the next part of the text under our belts before we finish today. We might have to return to this next week. Joshua 13, verse 15. And Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of the people of Reuben according to their clans. So their territory was from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and the city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland by Medeba, with Heshbon and all its cities that are in the tableland, Dibon and Bamoth Baal and Beth Baal Meon and Yahaz and Kedemot and Mapaat and Kiriataim and Sibma and Zeret Shahar in the hill of the valley, and Beth Peor and the slopes of Pisgah and Beth Yeshemot, that is all the cities of the tableland, and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses defeated with the leaders of Midian, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Rebah, and the princes of Sidon who lived in the land. Balaam also, the son of Beor, the one who practiced divination, was killed with the sword by the people of Israel among the rest of their slain. And the border of the people of Reuben was the Jordan as a boundary. This was the inheritance of the people of Reuben according to their clans with their cities and villages. All right, now as we go through this, I know this is kind of like reading genealogies sometime, where it can be easy for our eyes to glaze over as we're reading all these Hebrew names that we have no idea like what they're about, what they mean, where they're at. They're not important to us at all. We're going to try to give some sense to all of this, like we do with the genealogies, right? They are there for a reason, and there's something fruitful for us to get out of them. This description of Reuben's territory is the longest in this section. You know, we'll get a separate description for Gad and for the half-tribe of Manasseh. The short of it is that the tribe of Reuben inhabits the territory formerly held by the Amorites under King Sihon, which we read about in the book of Numbers. Right, Israel goes to war with King Sihon and defeats him while they are still wandering in the wilderness. This territory that Reuben takes includes Beth Peor. This is going to be the last note that we make today. We'll pick up next week. Beth Peor was already an infamous site in Israel's history. Because the text kind of mentions what happens there. Does anybody remember what happens at Beth Peor? What Israel does at Beth Peor? It's connected to Balaam. I'll give you that hint. So, yeah, that happens beforehand, where Balaam tries to curse Israel, and God won't let him curse Israel. There's something that happens after that. Do you remember, Rita? It was, yes. This is where Balaam incited the women of the land to seduce the sons of Israel to worship Baal Peor. All right, you should remember that Baal is not a formal name, but a title. Right? The word Baal means Lord. Yeah, so at some point in Israel's history, they probably would have referred to God as a Baal, because the meaning of the word was just Lord. And it's after the idolatry starts that they come to recognize, hey, wait a minute, we need to stop using this word Baal as a description of our God and reserve it just for these other gods. So what Israel does is they worship the Lord of Peor at the house of Peor. That's what Bet Peor means. Bet is the Hebrew word for house. Now, if you look at the other place names here in Reuben's list, what you see is that Beth Peor is not the only house in Reuben's territory. You've also got Bet Baal Meon, all right, the house of the Lord of Meon. All right, what does that imply to us? There's another pagan god belonging specifically to the city Meon. And what's probably going to happen? Israel's probably going to worship him at some point. You've got Bet Peor, you've got Bet Yeshemot, the house of Yeshemot. You have all of these places. Again, the text hinting at us that the seeds of Israel's future idolatry are being planted here. And we get this, this piles on top of the note that we got earlier in the text in verse 13. Yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacat dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. That's going to be the kind of beat that we are going to hear constantly over the rest of the book of Joshua, and especially once we get into the book of Judges. All right, I've gone over long. I need to shut up. Thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments this morning, and we'll pick this up next week.